we are during a global pandemic, and I don't know who thought it was a good idea to put 20,000 people in a room with masks optional.
You did, you motards. Fox News. That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Here I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, and 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake, California. Also in Red Bluff and Redding, California on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. In Grand Rapids on WPRR. In New Orleans on WHIV. Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for you. On the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. You can run, but you can't hide from The Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com, though your mileage may vary. Glad you could join us today. Since last Friday, it has been one thing after another. After another, each pushing the other thing down the front page, which may work out well for Donald Trump. I don't know, but I think we're going to need a bigger front page. We'll be joined shortly by a long-term veteran of the Department of Justice, also the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, and also the judicial system itself, to discuss what I think is the biggest story of the moment, the one now receiving likely the littlest coverage thanks to everything else. And that is the attempted but momentarily failed, before it was successful, Friday night massacre. The firing of Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, which is currently investigating a number of Trump cronies and Trump himself in his own district in Manhattan. And then, yes, the successful Saturday morning massacre of Berman, who was fired after he refused to resign on Friday night, all carried out by Donald Trump's fixer and the most corrupt attorney general in U.S. history, hands down, Bill Barr. Former Deputy Assistant U.S. Attorney General Lisa Graves will join us shortly to explain the extraordinary turn of events on Friday night and Saturday morning, and just how unprecedented this all is and what it means going forward. If time, we'll also try to chat about the similarly unprecedented Bill Barr DOJ corruption of the Michael Flynn case. And if time allows, and if she has the time, perhaps we'll open up the phones to some of your questions for her on all of the above at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Ask a former deputy assistant attorney general, if time. But first, well, let's just start climbing this mountain today. Tuesday is primary election day in both New York and Kentucky, after New York's original primary date was moved from April due to the COVID crisis, and Kentucky's was pushed back from May. And while the presidential primary is no longer contested, with Joe Biden as the presumptive Democratic nominee, that race is still on the ballot in New York, and delegates And in Kentucky. But there was a question about whether it would remain on the ballot in New York. And delegates will be selected for both Sanders and Biden. And that will make a difference in how progressive the party's platform and Biden's campaign eventually is. So that's an important election in that regard on Tuesday. But moreover, there are a number of competitive congressional primaries on the ballot and down in Kentucky. There is also an interesting race for the Democratic U.S. Senate nomination, with former fighter pilot Amy McGrath thought to be the establishment pick. Well, she is the establishment pick to take on Mitch McConnell for his Senate seat this November in Kentucky. But two progressives, Charles Booker and Mike Breuer, are also still in the running in that race. And I interviewed Breuer on this program a few weeks ago. So we'll be keeping our eyes on that. But Kentucky is also having trouble because they have severely cut down their number of polling places, ostensibly due to the COVID crisis in some of the most Democratic-leaning areas. Kentucky cut the number of polling places for Tuesday's primary from 3,700 down to 200. 3,700 before, now it's 200 in Kentucky.
Just 200 for the entire state?
That means there will be one polling place. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
That means there will be one polling place for 616,000 registered voters in Louisville's Jefferson County, where half of the state's black voters just happen to live. This following just weeks after the police killing of 26-year-old African-American emergency medical technician Breonna Taylor in Kentucky, in Louisville, while she was in her own home just sleeping and was woken up by a no-knock police warrant. So Kentucky is likely to be a mess on Tuesday. We will follow it and let you know as we try to keep up with everything. Yes, everything at once. Because we need a bigger front page. As to our own elections, by the way, here in LA County, something I had hoped to talk about today, but won't be able to get into detail. The LA, of course, the largest voting jurisdiction in the nation. Well, we broke news on Friday that the county is sticking with its terrible, failed $300 million, 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting and electronic poll book system. This November for the critical presidential race, what could possibly go wrong? I was on CBS 2 News here in Los Angeles with investigative reporter David Goldstein on Friday night to discuss the county's plans. But as I am short on time today, I will have to go into details on that in the days ahead. Also, by the way, if you're listening live in our Southern California listening area, I will apparently again be on CBS 2 News tonight, I believe, at 5 p.m., if I recall, along with Goldstein again to discuss a new and a very much related story on all of this that he will be breaking. I don't want to beat David to the punch there. So if you're in L.A., watch CBS 2 tonight at 5 p.m., or don't, if you'd prefer not to see me, and I do understand. Otherwise, I will try to pick up all of those stories in the days ahead here on the broadcast. And I've posted the story from Friday, by the way, at bradblog.com, if you'd like to get a look at that and my appearance with David last week on the CBS 2 News. At the same time, in case you haven't noticed, the COVID crisis is not going away anytime soon. Despite much of the country acting as if, pretending as if it is. The major thrust of new coronavirus cases now in the U.S. is in the South and West, where officials say more young people are now ignoring social distancing measures and testing positive for the virus. While young people are more likely to have milder outcomes from the virus, they can still infect others who are then more at risk, like their parents and their grandparents and, frankly, anybody who they walk by on the street. Those people are suddenly more at risk. So thanks, young people. Dr. Tom Frieden, the former director of the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, said on Twitter, with younger age of recent infections in at least some places, such as Florida, expect a lower death rate in this wave, until the 20 to 40-year-olds who are infected today go on to infect others. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, told Axios that the recent high number of cases in young people is, quote, not surprising, but like Frieden, he warned, they get infected first, then they come home, and then they infect the older people. The older people get the complications, and then they go to the hospitals. Fauci added, the death rate always lags several weeks behind the infection rate.
And I'll just add one other thing, that increasingly as more young people are becoming infected, they are finding that some of them are ending up with having long-term organ problems, like long-term lung damage and difficulty that it takes months and months to recover from. So it isn't a cakewalk just because the symptoms are supposedly milder
for young people. Yeah.
Milder meaning as in, hey, maybe you don't get hospitalized, maybe you don't die, but you might have long-term or actually permanent lung damage.
I should note that death rate in fact, are falling in the U.S., but infection rates and hospitalizations in many states continues to rise, even as all rates are now falling in Europe and Asia, just not here for some strange reason. We'll get to that strange reason in a moment. But across the U.S., experts are highlighting the need for social distancing and face covers. But parts of the country remain divided on wearing face masks in public, and more officials have considered making face coverings in public a requirement, like we have done now out here in California. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, Donald Trump's own former commissioner of the FDA, said masking has become controversial on Face the Nation on Sunday. He said it shouldn't be. It's a simple intervention. It's a collective action we can all take to help protect our fellow citizens and also protect ourselves and try to reopen the economy safely. But this is not good in a vast majority of states right now. Things are getting worse in many of them. There are 23 states now seeing rises in new reported cases compared to the previous week. That, according to Johns Hopkins University, leading the way is, sadly, California and Texas and Florida and Arizona. In California, the number of people hospitalized with coronavirus is the highest it has been since the beginning of the pandemic. In Texas, one of the first states to push forward with reopening, one mayor said that he wished the state reopened more slowly. Austin Mayor Steve Adler said on Sunday night, when the governor started reopening, I wish he had done it a little slower, so we could have seen the numbers in each one of the phases before we moved on to the next phase. But no, Texas does not have time for that. Arizona, where Donald Trump plans to travel on Tuesday, continues to see its new cases climb. The state averaged about 2,412 new reported cases per day over the week ending June 21. That is up about 94%. From the previous seven-day period, according to Johns Hopkins. It is now a much shorter list to detail the states where cases are falling rather than states where they are rising. While 23 states are now seeing cases rise, another 10 are remaining plateaued, essentially steady. Only 17 states are now seeing a decline in new cases. Those are, in alphabetical order, Alabama, Alaska, Connecticut, Illinois, Louisiana, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Mississippi, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Dakota, and Vermont. If you did not hear your state listed there, that means your state is probably moving up and that you should be taking extra precautions as things are getting worse, not better there. And if you live in one of those 17 states where rates are supposedly declining, well, especially as things are opening up again, you should be concerned that things could turn around at any moment. We still have no cure, no vaccine. There are some treatments that are moderately improving for folks. But as University of Arizona epidemiologist Dr. Purnima Madivanan told me last week on the broadcast, as she called on her state to close the border of Phoenix, quote, like yesterday, things are changing very quickly, and we are not only no better off than we were back in March and April. She says we are worse because the disease is far more widespread and now it is shedding like crazy. So if you were concerned in March or April, you should be even more concerned now. The weekend produced the same just out of control case counts in the South and the Southwest. The cases increases cannot be explained by increased testing alone. On Friday, one quarter of Arizona tests were found positive. One quarter, 25%. That is up from around 8% back on Memorial Day when these rises began. Florida had a record one-day case count on Friday, where about a quarter of Alabama's total cases have come in the last week. Remember, Alabama was one of the states that I just read where it was supposed to be declining. Well, maybe not so much anymore. Nationwide, on Saturday, the U.S. registered the highest case numbers since May 1. It's crazy. And speaking of crazy and one of the worst hotspots in the nation, Oklahoma is where our stable genius president chose to hold a super spreader event indoors on Saturday at the rather ironically named, in this instance, BOK Center. It drives me nuts every time I've heard that. It's Bank, Bank of Oklahoma, but it's called
BOK.
BOK.
Sounds very benign.
That's in Tulsa. It was not benign. In Tulsa, the infection rates have been spiking bigly over the past week or two. I suppose the good news from Trump's super spreader campaign rally on Saturday at the BOK Center was that it wasn't quite as super, that super spreader event, as the campaign had promised. When they repeatedly told us last week that more than 1 million people, 1 million people, had signed up to attend the event that was held in the 19,000-seat BOK Center. As it turns out, barely more than 6,000 people showed up. If you're math impaired, that would be nowhere near 1 million people. And of course, this was to Trump's great consternation and his reported anger and utter embarrassment at these numbers, as they had set up an outside overflow venue that both he and Pence were going to speak at. But there were about 20 people, literally, maybe 20 people at that outside venue. So it was canceled, and the indoor arena was not even half full. Sad. That's not what he promised us in the days leading up to the big event on Saturday.
As you probably have heard, and we're getting exact numbers out, but we're either close to or over 1 million people wanting to go. We have a 22,000-seat arena, but I think we're going to also take the convention hall next door, and that's going to hold 40,000. So we'll have 22,000 plus 40,000, which would mean that we'd have over 900,000 people that won't be able to go, but hopefully they'll be watching. And we expect to have, it's like a record-setting crowd. We've never had an empty seat, and we certainly won't in Oklahoma.
Yeah, you certainly will in Oklahoma, as it turns out. Whole bunch of empty seats, more than half of the arena, according to city officials. So, yeah, sad. Still, even more sad was the brutal coverage of the event. I'll share just a bit of that, since it all tended to overshadow what I think is a far more important story that we will discuss with my guest momentarily. But from the New York Times, Trump rally fizzles as attendance falls short of campaign's expectations. Ouch, that's got a sting. The lead, President Trump's attempt to revive his reelection campaign, sputtered badly on Saturday as he traveled to Tulsa for his first mass rally in months and found a far smaller crowd than his aides had promised him, then delivered a disjointed speech that did not address the multiple crises facing the nation or scandals battering him in Washington. The weakness of Trump's drawing power and political skills in a state that voted for him overwhelmingly. By the way, Oklahoma voted for Trump by 36 points. And they couldn't even fill up a hockey stadium? Anyway, A state that voted overwhelmingly for him and in a format that he favors. All of that raised new questions about his electoral prospects for a second term at a time when his poll numbers were already falling. And rather than speak to the wide cross-section of Americans who say they are concerned about police violence and systemic racism, he continued to use racist language himself, describing the coronavirus as, quote, Kung Flu. Yes, he really did. From CNN, sick staff and empty seats, how Trump's triumphant return to the campaign trail went from bad to worse. By the time Donald Trump was gliding in his helicopter toward Joint Base Andrews on Saturday, destined for what he'd hoped would be a triumphant, packed-to-the-rafters return to the campaign trail, things were already looking bad. Scanning cable news coverage earlier in the day, Trump was disappointed to see pictures not of massive lines forming outside the BOK Center in Tulsa, but of Jeffrey Berman, the federal prosecutor Trump's attorney general had attempted unsuccessfully to dismiss the night before. Hours later, the president was informed six campaign staffers in Tulsa had tested positive for coronavirus ahead of his arrival, an unfortunate reminder of an ongoing pandemic Trump's critics say he is ignoring. After initially dismissing the revelation, a source familiar with his reaction said Trump erupted when it was subsequently reported in the media, overtaking coverage of the rally itself. And this breaking news, as we are on our way into the studio today, two more campaign staffers have now tested positive for COVID. Actually, are they campaign staffers or are they White House staffers?
I believe they are campaign staffers, yeah. But I'll look that up for sure. But I think it's really interesting how reality refuses to conform to Trump's will.
Still, a determined Trump, according to CNN, was intent on breathing new life into his staggering campaign. He took off for Tulsa, convinced that large swaths of his supporters would be waiting for him there, and telling reporters as much, even on the White House lawn as he boarded the chopper to head out.
The event in Oklahoma is unbelievable. The crowds are unbelievable. They haven't seen anything like it. And we will go there now.
Yes, keyword unbelievable, I think, is things did not improve after Air Force One lifted off. The president received a report that only about 25 people were assembled in the overflow space that the campaign had reserved for a crowd that Trump claimed days earlier would top 40,000. 2 hours before the rally was to begin, people who signed up for tickets received an urgent text message from the Trump campaign, essentially begging them. No, I know I almost said Trump campaign, essentially begging him to begging these people to show up. Quote, the great American comeback celebration's almost here, the text message read, adding desperately, there's still space. When the president landed in Tulsa at 5:51 p.m., his crowds had the crowds his aides had promised him had failed to materialize. Air Force One flew over the arena where Trump had been told thousands of supporters would be waiting to hear from him before he went inside, but saw nothing resembling the sea of people he had been expecting. While he was in the air, the campaign had canceled the outside appearance, given the lack of apparent enthusiasm. Other than the embarrassment of so few people willing to risk their life to show up to hear this yutz, and very few of those who did so willing to wear masks inside this dangerous venue because apparently they are yutzes as well, Trump's nearly two-hour speech was universally panned as disjointed, as a return to his racist 2016 campaign themes. He spent about 15 minutes explaining why it was so difficult for him to walk down that ramp at West Point a week or so ago, or to lift a glass of water to his face with one single hand, though he did show everyone that he could still do that on Saturday. He actually drank with one hand out of a glass of water. Who says our president is not great? So I guess there were some small victories. He also admitted that he had been, and here's where the news comes in, some actual news, he had been slow walking coronavirus testing around the country.
You know, testing is a double-edged sword. Here's the bad part.
When you test, when you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people. You're going to find more cases. So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please.
Slow the testing down. Slow the testing down. Now, yeah, you're going to find more people when you do more testing. You're also going to find more people who test negative when you do more testing. And hopefully the percentages of those people positive versus negative are coming down, but they are not. So when he says we're having more cases because we're doing more testing, that, you'll be shocked to learn, is a lie from the president of the United States. Go figure. Now, after that, he was asked, the White House was asked whether, about that comment, because they claimed that he was joking about slowing testing down, that he hadn't told the staff to slow things down. But of course, I don't believe the White House any more about that than I believe that there were going to be 1 million people who wanted to come out to a stupid campaign rally. As he was asked about it today by a reporter at the White House, he made pretty clear, no, he was actually not joking at all.
Nobody thought that.
But did you ask to slow it down?
If it did slow down, frankly, I think we're way ahead of ourselves, if you want to know the truth. We've done too good a job.
We've done too good a job? We are ahead of ourselves? We're finding out about positive cases before they're actually positive? What the hell is this clown talking about? The New York Times later reported exactly what went wrong was still being dissected on Sunday with the Oklahoma rally, but a broad group of advisors and associates acknowledged to one another that Trump had not been able to will public opinion away from fears about the spread of coronavirus in an indoor space. Correct. He was not able to pretend it away. Even his dumb supporters were not dumb enough to believe that lie. And, the Times says, they conceded that myriad polls show Trump's eroding standing were not fake and that he might be on course to lose to former Vice President Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, in November. Even Fox News had trouble spinning this one away this morning on Fox and Friends.
We are at during a global pandemic, and I don't know who thought it was a good idea to put 20,000 people in a room and with masks optional.
You did, you dumb clod. You and all the other dumb clods at Fox News who have been having orgasms about President Trump's tremendous relaunch, the Great American Comeback Celebration. I was watching Fox News at the beginning of the rally, and their own Jesse Waters, dumbest man on earth, although it's a close call over there, was going on and on about how packed the arena was, that he was about to appear before a packed arena. It wasn't packed, and you could even see that on Fox News' own camera. How dumb do they think their viewers are? Don't answer that question.
And it was also funny because he said that right after a reporter said, well, the arena certainly isn't full. And he says, well, it sure does look full.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, we will try to make sense of all of this somehow, because not what happened on Saturday in Oklahoma, but what happened that you didn't hear about because of what happened on Saturday in Oklahoma. So never mind that. Yes, it was fun, if horrifying, to watch all of those folks who may find themselves very, very sick in a week or so. But the real news took place on Friday night and on Saturday morning as Donald Trump and or Bill Barr tried to fire the U.S. attorney in Manhattan who is leading the investigations into a whole lot of crimes by Donald Trump and his cronies. We will try to make sense of that story next with former U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General Lisa Graves and maybe some of your calls if we got time. Got a question about the firing of Jeffrey Berman in New York or the Michael Flynn case or the unprecedented corruption of a U.S. Attorney General named William Barr? Give us a call, 818-985-5735. Told you we need a bigger front page. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. If you haven't noticed by now, it's no easy feat finding facts, real facts, not alternative facts, over your public airwaves. We try to bring you real facts, truth, and clarity without fear or favor each and every day on the broadcast. But we need your help to do it. If you enjoy the show and or get something from it, please give back a bit if you can by visiting us at bradblog.com/donate. Your support helps Desi and me continue to bring you real, independent, progressive news 5 days a week over your public airwaves. We simply can't do it without your help, and that help is needed more now than ever. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today to make a one-time donation or, even better, automated monthly support. It'll take you about 60 seconds, and you can rest easy knowing that we'll be here every day making sense of it all, or at least trying to. That's bradblog.com/donate, and thanks. Yep, things were changing in a New York minute late on Friday night as the U.S. Attorney General, pretty much out of nowhere, attempted to fire Donald Trump's U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Jeffrey Berman. Welcome back to the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. By the way, if you can't get through to us or we run out of time here, you can also tweet me. I am the Brad Blog. I'll try to keep my eyes on the Twitter feed today. Jeffrey Berman is a longtime supporter of Donald Trump's. He was a donor to his 2016 campaign. He worked on his transition, one whose office, whose U.S. attorney office, has shown a great deal of independence over the years and over the past few years, even under Donald Trump, in investigating and prosecuting Trump, his companies, and a number of his cronies, including the prosecution of Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, Rudy Giuliani's so-called business associates, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. And reportedly, Rudy Giuliani himself, along with the Trump Organization and all of its financial chicanery. While the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, where Trump's businesses are based, is the Southern District of New York office, or SDNY. It's also sometimes referred to as the Sovereign District of New York, since the office, which is a branch of the Department of Justice, is known historically to be very independent from main justice. So here is what happened on Friday night, if you missed it, and I wouldn't blame you if you did. Attorney General Bill Barr issued a statement claiming that Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. attorney at SDNY, had resigned. He said, "I am pleased to announce that President Trump intends to nominate Jay Clayton, currently the chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission," who, by the way, has no prosecutorial experience. I think he is an attorney, but other than that. Jay Clayton to serve as the next U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. On my recommendation, Barr said, the president has appointed Craig Carpenito, currently the U.S. attorney for the District of New Jersey, to serve as the acting U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York while the Senate is considering Jay Clayton's nomination. This appointment will be effective July 3, and Craig will work closely with the outgoing U.S. attorney to ensure a smooth transition. Finally, Bill Barr added, "I thank Jeffrey Berman, who is stepping down after 2.5 years of service as U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. With tenacity and savvy, Jeff has done an excellent job leading one of our nation's most significant U.S. attorney's offices, achieving many successes on consequential civil and criminal matters. I appreciate his service to the Department of Justice and our nation, and I wish him well in the future," said the Attorney General Bill Barr late on Friday night. Well, sounds like Jeff Berman did a great job. But it also sounds, as we would then learn just not too many minutes later, that Jeff Berman had not resigned at all. He had been fired, or they attempted to fire him. Why would they do that if he was doing such a great job, according to the Attorney General? That was a bombshell as it came in late on Friday night, of course. Adding to the curiousness of that announcement was the fact that the U.S. attorney from New Jersey was announced to be taking over the office as acting USA. That would normally be done by the deputy to the U.S. attorney who was stepping down. Why are they bringing in someone from somewhere else to this office? But an even bigger bombshell would come, as I said, just a few minutes later, as Berman released his own statement in response to Barr, making clear that no, he did not resign. And he had no intention of stepping down because even if he was fired, he couldn't be fired by law by the attorney general. Berman's statement read, "I learned in a press release from the attorney general tonight that I was, quote, stepping down as U.S. attorney. I have not resigned, and I have no intention of resigning. No intention of resigning my position, to which I was appointed by the judges of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. I will step down when a presidentially appointed nominee is confirmed by the Senate. Until then," he writes, "our investigations will move forward without delay or interruption." He said, "I cherish every day that I work with the men and women of this office to pursue justice without fear or favor and intend to ensure that this office's important cases continue unimpeded." Well, finally, someone standing up to this president and his corrupt attorney general. Unfortunately, that changed again in a New York minute the next morning as it was announced that the president of the United States himself had fired Berman. And then Berman released a second statement saying, "In light of Attorney General Bill Barr's decision to respect the normal operation of law and have a deputy U.S. attorney become acting U.S. attorney, I will be leaving the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York effective immediately." He says, "It's been the honor of a lifetime to serve as the district's U.S. attorney and a custodian of its proud legacy, but I could leave the district in no better hands than Deputy U.S. Attorney Audrey Strauss's. She is the smartest, most principled, and effective lawyer with whom I have ever had the privilege of working, and I know that under her leadership, this office is unparalleled. Assistant U.S. attorneys, investigators, paralegals, and staff will continue to safeguard the Southern District's enduring tradition of integrity and independence." Not long thereafter, when asked about it, Donald Trump said he knew nothing about any of it and that Bill Barr was handling the matter. So did Trump really fire Berman at all? Does it matter? And will Bill Barr keep his promise to allow Audrey Strauss to remain in control of the office, or will she be fired next? And why, by the way, is all of this happening in the first place? Jeff Berman, as Josh Marshall notes, is not a deep state hanger-on. He was a former law partner of Rudy Giuliani. He was a campaign donor. And the fact that he ended up being appointed formally by the judges in the district, not by Trump himself, is due to the dubious circumstances of his original appointment. Berman served on Trump's presidential team, and Trump personally interviewed Berman before agreeing to nominate him to the New York position, which the Senate would not have looked highly on, especially while that office was busy investigating Trump himself. The head of that office has jurisdiction over Trump's literal home turf. Joining us now to try and make some sense of this is someone who understands the workings of the DOJ and the court system and the Senate confirmation process, perhaps as good as anyone else in this nation. Lisa Graves is the former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the U.S. Justice Department under Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. She is the former chief counsel for nominations in the U.S. Senate and former deputy chief for the U.S. court system. She is now founder of TrueNorthResearch.org, which is a watchdog group advancing core American values, according to their website, through researching the forces distorting our democracy. Well, that doesn't take much research these days. Lisa Graves, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you for that rousing introduction of me.
This is mind-blowing, Lisa. So as it turns out, as of Friday night, according to the law, at least as I understand it, neither Bill Barr nor Donald Trump had the legal right to fire Berman because he was appointed by the federal district court in the Southern District. So did Trump have any more right to fire him on Saturday if, in fact, he actually did so?
Well, it's very unclear exactly what happened in this circumstance, because you have a U.S. attorney that, as you said, works in an independent way from the president. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be independent of the president. And you end up with this situation where Trump fires him, but then basically says he didn't. And now his spokesperson this morning or this afternoon, in essence, said that he didn't fire him. And so this is, you know, a debacle in terms of the rule of law. Meanwhile, you have a president out on the campaign trail claiming he's the rule of law president, which is astonishing given everything we've seen. And so I would say this to you, in general, under the U.S. Department of Justice's rules, U.S. attorney can be let go, can be replaced, but not for any legal reason, any legal purpose. And in this instance,
it's Lisa, you say not for an illegal purpose, correct? Okay.
Yes, not a U.S. attorney can be fired, mm-hmm. And we've certainly seen that happen. And there was a big investigation in the Bush administration mm-hmm. about that sort of thing.
Yep.
And after the Inspector General examined all the circumstances there, one of the things he made clear is that while the president and the attorney general, in essence, have discretion to fire a U.S. attorney, they can do so for any reason or no reason other than an illegal reason. And I think with the statement of Jeff Berman and with, you know, the things we've been seeing coming out of the Southern District, mm-hmm. I think there's a reason to believe that this may very well have been done for any legal reason, for the purpose of obstruction of justice.
Yeah, I mean, this was before Trump actually reportedly fired Berman on Saturday. I saw someone on Twitter, a law professor, saying if Trump goes on record firing him, it's open obstruction of justice, since the case at SDNY involves Trump. Now, we don't know if, in fact, let me ask you, do we even know what it was that Berman was believed to be investigating that apparently made it so important that Donald Trump had to somehow carry this out on a Friday night, Saturday morning massacre suddenly at a time when I guess they thought it wouldn't get as much media attention? Do we know what they're trying to cover up?
We do not know, but there certainly has been some reporting that the U.S. Attorney's Office there has been investigating Rudy Giuliani. And Rudy Giuliani, as you know, has been acting as the president's private lawyer in many ways and as his representative, his agent, in a lot of dealings that have been called into question for their legality.
Mm-hmm.
Giuliani has been this president's agent in Ukraine and in other ways. And you have a situation where with everything we've seen from this White House, from this president, and from this attorney general, I think it's a reasonable speculation that this was for obstruction. This was to obstruct. And I think the statement of Berman,
mm-hmm.
In which he was saying, you know, our investigations will continue unimpeded. And then the statement on Saturday, in essence, resigning mm-hmm. In response, you know, again, noting the importance of the investigations going forward, I think any reasonable person would conclude that this was an effort to impede those investigations, and including the fact that, as Berman pointed out, this was highly irregular to try to bring in another political appointee from New Jersey
mm-hmm.
to oversee that office. And presumably, the fear is that that person would have been charged with getting rid of evidence, with trying mm-hmm. to thwart an investigation, otherwise shut it down in a way that might be impermissible, try to use permissible ways, I suppose, to shut down an investigation. And so this all smells. It reeks. It's really a terrible crisis for the United States, for the Department of Justice, for the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, and for the very rule of law. You cannot have a president who fires people who are investigating him or who are investigating his associates. You have to have a president who is as far away as possible from appearing,
mm-hmm.
even appearing to interfere in that sort of investigation or any investigation that might touch on him. And as mm-hmm. you pointed out, Brad, this is a U.S. attorney who has, in fact, investigated and convicted people who are close to the president, like Michael Cohen
mm-hmm.
and Michael Cohen's associates, who are also, in turn, Donald Trump's associates, the former Russian citizens that you mentioned. Here we are about 5 months from the election with a president behaving as if the law does not apply to him. And then in some strange way in these last 48 hours, suggesting that he wasn't even the person deciding what was happening. And then they've made up all these after-the-fact justifications claiming that they had to do it because Jay Clayton, the head of the SEC, supposedly wanted to move to New York. Which is a flimsy reason, if any. As you point out, Jay Clayton is not someone who's ever served as a U.S. attorney before. He was with a private law firm, Sullivan & Cromwell, and that's a firm that represented a bunch of oil companies and fossil fuel companies in climate litigation, by the way. And so, you know, you have a political appointee who's quite frankly, in my view, done a pretty bad job as the head of the SEC in terms of enforcing our securities laws, supposedly being handpicked to go up to New York for the last 5 or 6 months, potentially, of this administration. And that's the supposed rationale. The other rationale they floated is the idea that Berman didn't go along with objecting to the anti-COVID restrictions in New York, the stay-at-home orders, which is quite frankly an outrageous thing if that were suggested as the basis, because New York has been the you know, sort of ground zero in terms of the number of people affected by this deadly disease. And so, you know, you have a bunch of lies, I think, coming out of this administration. You have a man at the Department of Justice at the helm, Bill Barr, who I think is crooked and has behaved in crooked ways from the beginning to the end through now of his tenure. And you have this extraordinary interference with an independent prosecutor, not an actual independent prosecutor, but someone who takes his independence seriously as a prosecutor in the form of Jeff Berman.
Now, I mean, as you described, Lisa Graves, it is lies upon lies upon lies. It is very difficult to figure out which, you know, which lie is which at this point, because the guy who they want to have come in and replace Berman, as you said, he's a Trump apparatchik, works for the oil companies, but he would be replacing Berman, who himself was on the transition team, gave money to the campaign. So it's not as if, you know, this guy was, you know, some lefty pinko that they were trying to push out in this case. Would and it's, well, a couple of questions here. And by the way, if you have some questions, we'll try to fit in a phone call or two if we have time. 818-985-5735 for Lisa Graves, 818-985-KPFK. But, you know, well, a whole bunch of questions. Barr is the head of the DOJ, but if it was for a corrupt purpose in firing him, now it's confusing because Berman appears to have resigned at this point, doesn't actually appear to be a firing, but they're saying it was a firing. Well, if you can't fire them for corrupt, unlawful purposes, why were they trying to fire him in the first place? Because Barr's own statement says what a terrific job that Jeff Berman was doing. An excellent job leading one of our nation's most significant offices. So if it was a firing, how can they even make up an excuse that is not actually unlawful? And if it is unlawful, who would bring charges for something like that?
Well, that is a great question, Brad. You always ask the deep and hard questions. This is a situation in which, you know, we right after the election, I was called by some reporters about what to expect in this administration, and one of the things I said is that the rule of law is a thin reed. We have come to rely upon it in the United States. We expect our leaders at the highest offices to follow the rule of law, but in fact, it's very hard to enforce if you have people at the top who are who disregard it. And here you have a situation in which if in fact Bill Barr was trying to obstruct justice or helping Trump to obstruct justice in this case or interfere in a prosecution, who would arrest Bill Barr?
Right.
Who would be in a position to pursue him? What U.S. attorney could begin to bring a grand jury investigation of Barr's activities? If there were an indictment, what would happen? Who would enforce that indictment? And quite frankly, here where the president himself is involved in this firing is someone who, I think there's demonstrable evidence has obstructed justice in the past and appears to, potentially be doing so here. How does our country, how does our law enforcement, our federal law enforcement go about enforcing the law,
against the President of the United States, who appears to think that he's above the law while he goes around the country and lies to his followers claiming he's a rule of law president.
Well, and we've
his
already...
The rule of law is only him. It's only him.
And he's demonstrated that the president is clearly above the rule of law, but now it seems like we're elevating the attorney general to being above the rule of law. If a U.S. attorney, in order to file an indictment against Bill Barr, would have to get the permission of Bill Barr, it kind of seems like we've got a problem here. Now, the House does have the power to impeach the attorney general, as I understand it. He clearly lied in his announcement to the American people, that Berman had resigned when he hadn't. That's a violation of the public trust. He's required by statute to mind that. That alone seems like an impeachable offense. Lisa Graves, has any cabinet-level executive official ever actually been impeached? Do you know? Because I know the Constitution gives Congress that right, but I don't know if they've ever actually exercised it.
Well, there have been efforts to impeach people in essence in all three branches of the government, or to remove them from office. Most of the people who have been removed from impeachment have actually been judges and not from the executive branch, or removed in essence from the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But in this circumstance, you have this real crisis in our democracy, which is the result of the fact that Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate leader, who's a Republican from Kentucky, has basically allowed this president to go unpunished, undeterred from the investigation by Robert Mueller. And that has had an effect on, in some ways, whether the House of Representatives will bring an impeachment, a bill of impeachment, because McConnell has indicated that he would do anything and everything to prevent the president or any of his allies from being impeached. And so in some ways, I believe the House should act appropriately and pursue the impeachment of Bill Barr and, quite frankly, President Trump again for these issues and perhaps some of the issues that have been raised by John Bolton in his book. The political reality is we're very close to this election, only a couple months away, and in some ways there's a notion that this is going to have to be resolved politically in terms of how people vote, if they're able to vote under this president, given his efforts to destroy mail-in voting.
Yeah,
crisis.
Of course, Lisa, why we always talk about elections every day, not just in the days right before an election, but every day, because it remains the last firewall. Let me get in one quick question. We're running late as usual. Let me get one question for you, Lisa Graves. Our phone number is 818-985-5735. Of course, the first one in through the door is Roger in Minneapolis, as ever. Hey, Roger, welcome to the broadcast. You got a question for Lisa Graves?
Yes, I'll keep it quick.
Thank you.
Ms. Graves, I'm going to ask you not so much a nuts and bolts question, but rather with your broad understanding of our system. It appears that with people of bad faith in high places, that our system can be subverted. Do you have faith that it can find a way to right itself?
Great question. Thanks, Roger. Can we fix this mess, Lisa, if, let's say, Donald Trump does not win the election and he is actually moved out of the White House somehow by January?
I think we can, and the reason is because I think that if there is a strong Congress, we can begin to change these laws that have allowed this type of behavior to run rampant. We can change the rules for these acting positions that have been exploited by a president like Trump. And we can do more to actually secure independent prosecutors to ensure that we do not have a situation as with Mr. Mueller, where he was, in essence, his investigation was cabined and restricted by the Justice Department and then distorted by Bill Barr himself. And so there are a number of important reforms that could pass very quickly, like with Watergate. Shortly after that, there was a movement for reform, and it imposed a lot of new protections. I think we could accomplish that. But more than that, I would say, we as a people have to come together and stand against this sort of corruption, no matter what party you are, just like Mr. Berman himself has a Republican, from his roots, has stood up to this president, has been independent. We need this rule of law to be independent of party, It needs to be something that everyone is bound by, including the president, no matter his party, including the attorney general, no matter his party. And so we as a people have to demand on that, no matter what our party is.
Lisa Graves, we're short on time. I got to jump out. She is the former Deputy Assistant AG at the U.S. Justice Department, former Chief Counsel for Nominations in the U.S. Senate, and former Deputy Chief for the U.S. Court System. She is now the founder of TrueNorthResearch.org, and she can be found on the Twitters at @TheLisaGraves. Lisa, I suspect we'll come up with some excuse or another to need to talk to you in the coming days, and I look forward to it.
Thanks, Fred. Thanks so much.
You bet. Take care.
Thanks.
All right, a quick break, and we are back with, I don't know what we have time for at this point. We'll find out right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to The Bradcast.
Hi, this is Desi Doyen from the Green News Report and The Bradcast. What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You gotta keep them separated.
Welcome back. It's The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Desi Doyen, we're running late for a change. Imagine that. I don't know how that happened. I never do that. So we have time. Do we have time for one more? It wouldn't be a Bradcast with calls if we didn't hear from Mo in Long Beach. Hey, Morris, welcome back to the Bradcast, my friend. What you got for us?
Hey, Brad, keep an eye on Kentucky. 2,440 polling places have been reduced to 177.
Yep.
Mitch McConnell is going to hold on to power by any means necessary. Keep an eye on that.
Oh, you bet I will. That's one of the reasons why we talked to U.S. Senate candidate down there, Mike Breuer, a few weeks ago. We will see if Amy McGrath can pull this off. There's also Charles Booker, another progressive who's running against her. And then any of them are going to have to take their run at Mitch McConnell, who is not very popular right now, and I think getting unpopular-er by the moment, at least if we're lucky. Anyway, if you're in Kentucky or New York trying to vote, please stay in line. Don't be cowed. Don't be pushed away. Stay healthy. Wear your masks. We got your back as best we can, and we will pick up those stories and many more in the days ahead. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my board operator today, the great Kiana Williams, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's Brad Blog or any other from all times, you can go and download it for free and share it with your friends and family. Unlike COVID, please don't share that with them. You can go to my website. It is bradblog.com. You can also drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am The Brad Blog. I will see you there until we see you back here, hopefully tomorrow. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.